Crime Wire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. Remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send Crime Wire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Kim Colton is manning the switchboard tonight. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Denny.
We may run into a snag tonight where our guest, who was going to discuss the Bugsy Siegel murder, ran into some conflicts and may or not be able to join us. So we're going to give him a few minutes to see if he can make
okay.
it in. And
if
go to plan B.
If I had his phone number, you have his phone number, if you could give him a jingle maybe on your cell or something and ask him to call in. It's always a shot.
Yeah.
Maybe he got the time mixed up. We're all over the country here.
Okay, well, do you want to tell the folks? I'll disconnect here, and I'll get back with you in a minute, and I'll go ahead and give them a call.
Okay, sounds great.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I'm just going to begin with an introduction, and hopefully we will hear from Warren Hall. The introduction here is, on the night of June 20th, 1947, notorious mobster Benjamin Bugsy Siegel was relaxing in the living room of his girlfriend Virginia Hill's mansion in Beverly Hills. Conveniently for her, she was away on vacation in Paris. But his trusted friend, Al Smiley, was with him. Suddenly, rifle shots rang out from outside the living room window. Two slugs struck Siegel in the face. One of them ejected his left eye, which was found on the floor some 15 feet away from his body. Bugsy was dead at the age of 41. Speculation swirled as to who killed Siegel and why. The most popular theory was that the gangster had gotten in hot water with his organized crime pals over his handling or mishandling of the Flamingo Casino Project in Las Vegas. Whatever the reason for the murder, no one has ever been charged in connection with Siegel's death, and it remains one of the more intriguing cold cases. However, in 2012, some 65 years after the killing, a man has emerged who believes he knows who pulled the trigger that night and the circumstances surrounding Siegel's death sentence. Denny had the pleasure of meeting with Warren Hall recently to hear about his research into Siegel's murder and his conclusions. Over nearly 3 hours, Warren presented his findings in great detail, and his argument was compelling. So much so, in fact, that Denny invited him to deliver his presentation on CrimeWire and let the listeners decide whether or not he has proved his case. Because of the tremendous amount of information that needs to be discussed, Warren will appear on two shows, on November 27th, which we're still crossing our fingers for. He'll lay out the facts as he knows them. 2 weeks later, on December 11th, after the audience has a chance to digest the information and do research of their own, Warren will be back to tie up any loose ends and take calls from the audience. But, of course, we'll see if those dates change. Denny, are you back on the line?
Yes, I just spoke with Warren. He was having trouble getting through for some reason, so he said he's going to try it again. We'll see what happens.
Okay. Okay, great. Well, I just read the introduction. And
here he is now, I believe.
Oh, yes, here he is. And is this Warren Hall?
Hi, yes, it is.
Oh, hi, Warren. This is Kim Colton, and Denny
hi,
is
Kim.
On the line with us. Welcome to CrimeWire.
Good deal. We had a little technical glitch there. Seems to be the pattern for me the past couple weeks.
Oh,
we
no.
Hackered modern technology.
You got to love it. You got to love it.
Got to love
it. I think
we
have it resolved now, so that's problem one solved. We're good troubleshooters.
Beautiful. Well, Warren, listen, welcome to the show. While I was disconnected, Kim read the show intro about Bugsy Siegel and so forth. And before we get into the details, I just want to tell the audience that I met with you, I think it was about 3 weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
and we talked for, I guess close to 3 hours about the Bugsy Siegel murder. And went through, you have actually have a PowerPoint about the case. And it was a very compelling presentation. I don't want to jump too far ahead.
Sure.
But your theory of the case, if you will, really makes sense when you look at all the circumstances and facts in total. So what I would like to do, I know that we don't have the benefit on radio of having the video to look at and some of the photos and so forth, which are unfortunate. However, am I correct, Warren, that you do have a website where some of those photos are available?
Yeah, we do. And actually, if people just want to log into their Facebook, we have a Facebook page, and it's titled Family Secret. And what we've done is we've tried to put up a lot of the photos. And this was since talking with you. We just kind of started the site again. And we're going to put it on Facebook for a while and let folks take a look at some of the photographs of the people that are involved in the story. Because like you, I'm a very visual person. Radio is a little bit more of a chore, but, you know, they used to do it back in the day. So I think the visuals will help people out, and hopefully we can tell a good story and get the case out there via radio, and I think we can do it fairly well.
What I'd like to do to start with, if you would, is tell the listeners a little bit about you and how you came to become interested in the Bugsy Siegel murder.
Sure. My wife and I, we had been lifelong educators. So, you know, we never really consider ourselves super sleuths by any stretch of the imagination. My background, I do have a little bit of background in investigations. I used to be a member of the National Security Agency way back in the day. And after that, I got into coaching and teaching, and we kind of went through our life, you know, as educators. I am now employed by the Clark County School District Police as the assistant to the chief of the police. I'm his executive assistant. So I'm involved in law enforcement around those guys a little bit. But we just kind of stumbled upon the Siegel situation, not by accident, because as you're going to find out, this has been a story that's been in our family for years and years. But it really became a mission of mine to resolve the case when my father had suffered a stroke back in 1996. And when Dad was on his deathbed, he wanted me to go and explore the factors and the circumstances of the Siegel crime. And back then, Denny, I really thought it was, okay, he wants me to solve this murder that we all know about. And as Annette and I have come to learn, it had nothing to do with that. We firmly believe that life is a journey and not a destination. And the journey we have had over the last 16 years of researching the Siegel murder has really allowed us to have a great life experience. So while a lot of people would go after this and say, hey, we want resolution on the Siegel murder, I certainly want that. But more importantly, the journey that we've been on and the people we've met and the opportunities we've had has just been so rewarding that I actually think that's what my dad was up to. And I think we've solved the crime, too, as a kind of a sidebar. But I really think that the 16 years that we've spent finding the information, finding people who have firsthand knowledge of the situation, finding the pieces of evidence that by an act higher than ours have come our way has just been incredible.
And, you know, I can relate to that because I know when I did one of my true crime books, I told the subject of the book that I said, if we never sell a book, of course, I didn't want to speak for him, but for me, if we never sold a copy of the book, the time that I put in talking with him and doing other research for the book was a learning experience that can never be taken away from me.
Oh, and you are absolutely right. Absolutely right. I mean, we've met some fascinating people, and you know, Annette is the kind of wife that would allow us to plan our vacations around research trips. So we've had a couple vacations that have been mostly in the bowels of the Los Angeles County Museum. So, you know, it has been that kind of experience for us that it's just been so fascinating. And again, you know, even if we didn't sell a single book or ever see this thing on a silver screen, you know, that's not the point. The point is the journey that we made and continue to make. So I can certainly relate to that.
Now, what I've inviting the audience, the listeners, to do, and we get a lot of listens to the archives. So people who listen to the show live, and then we get, over the course of the next several days, we will get hundreds of more listens, people that go to the archives and listen to the show. What I want to do is encourage all of them, people listening tonight or people who listen from the archives in the days ahead, to do your own research. You know, listen to what Warren has to say. He will give you names. He will give you places. He will give you years. You can do your own research. You can also visit the Family Secret Facebook page and maybe get a little more of a feel for some of the players in here. Some of the names you'll hear tonight you'll recognize immediately, others maybe not so much. And the beauty of archives is this: when the listener is doing his or her own research or own investigation, if they can go back and replay the show as frequently as needed to see if they missed any details or to get perhaps an address they didn't catch the first time or a name. So that's what I'm doing. Well, I'm going to encourage everybody to listen tonight and take notes or replay this from archives and check out some of the information on their own. And then when we do the follow-up in 2 weeks on December 11th, people who have questions or comments can call in and address them to you live. And does that sound reasonable?
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing is, if people want to and they have questions, they can feel free to contact me at that Family Secret Facebook page. I'm sure there's a way to shoot messages out. And any chance I get to talk to a person about this story, I usually take advantage of it because, like you're going to find out, this is a passion, and it's a passion for our family, and you know, it has been. So, absolutely. And knowledge.
Okay, I think we're ready to get
key.
Into the meat of your research. So I'll let you begin wherever it is you'd like to start.
Perfect. Okay. The first thing I'd like everybody to do is just kind of forget the movie Bugsy. You know, Bugsy was a great movie with Warren Beatty and Annette Bening, but as far as being historically accurate, throw the things out that you think you know about the Siegel murder. What I'd like to do is just kind of take people through the first part of the presentation is actually the facts and of what happened on June 20th. And there's a lot of misconceptions out there, but the bottom line is all its research came from newspaper research, FBI files, police reports, anything official. When I first went out to try to solve this thing, one of the things that I tried to do is to disprove the theory. That seemed to be the easiest way, and I couldn't do it. As more and more of the information came in, I also knew that if I was ever going to convince people that it was valid, that I would have to have independent research from the 30s and the 40s, and that's what we did with every piece of information that we're going to present tonight. So I'll start out with the Siegel murder and what happened on June 20th. And as most people know, Ben Siegel was killed in 1947 in Beverly Hills. And what had happened was Ben Siegel, Alan Smiley, and you had Llewellyn on a couple weeks ago, who is Alan's daughter, Chick Hill, and Virginia Hill's secretary was also in this dinner party that they had at Jack's Cafe down at the beach in Santa Monica. Well, the four of them returned to the house in Beverly Hills that Siegel was staying at, which was Virginia Hills. And Alan Smiley and Ben Siegel take position on the couch, and they are engaged in a conversation. Within a couple of minutes, Smiley hears what he thinks are firecrackers at first. He realizes they're shots. He sprawls on the floor, and he looks up, and he finds out that Ben Siegel is dead. Within 10 minutes of the Siegel murder, police arrive, and the investigation into the Siegel killing begins. There's a couple things out there that we need to dispel right away. One of the big myths is that Alan Smiley was involved in the Siegel murder. I take great exception to that, and I think Llewellyn mentioned it too. You have Alan Smiley sitting on a couch, and if he knows somebody is outside with an automatic weapon, I don't think it'd be real smart on Alan's part.
Hello?
Hello? Do I still have you, Denny?
Yeah.
You're still here. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Alan Smiley was not involved at all in the Siegel killing. It just makes no sense. So that's one of those myths that we want to dispel right away. The other myth that we want to dispel is that Maya Lansky had anything to do with the setup. Again, this isn't true. You know, Maya was Ben Siegel's best friend. Everything is going to point to one person being the person who kind of organizes this from the L.A. base, and that's going to be Jack Dragna, who's the L.A. crime boss. That's who police suspect first. So as we get going into the Siegel murder, all these different departments and agencies begin to arrive on scene. Beverly Hills PD, of course, is the first group that arrives. They are the Department of Jurisdiction. You have the LAPD, the L.A. County District Attorney, the L.A. County Sheriff's, the Coroner's Office. The following day, the State Attorney General shows up, and the FBI eventually gets there as well. In the first hours, and here's where I'd like people to take some notes, because these are the facts. In the first hours following Siegel's death, police discover several key pieces of evidence. The initial FBI report states that Siegel's killed with a .45 caliber machine gun. Denny, when we sat down and we shared things, I showed you the FBI files on these and the memos that came from the FBI, a special agent in charge. So the first memo comes out. It's a .45 caliber machine gun. Within an hour and a half, another memo comes out, and the weapon of choice is listed as a .30 caliber carbine. Now, later on, we're going to talk about the theory behind this and what I think happened during that. But for now, realize that police are going to start developing what we call a BOLO, be on the lookout for. These two items are going to be listed on that. Be on the lookout for a person who has in their possession a .40 caliber carbine and a possible .30 caliber carbine. Another thing that sticks out right away is that this is a very non-traditional mob hit. Mobsters like to do things up close and personal. Siegel could have been hit in Las Vegas. He could have been taken out to the desert. We have the pig farms out here. He could have been taken out in a traditional mob manner, but everybody thought it was a little bit unusual that the weapon of choice was a carbine, and the method of his murder was by sniper fire. Now, the FBI also reports that Siegel's killer was an excellent shot, and when you analyze the way that the shot was fired, it comes from an angle that is really requiring the expertise of a military-type person or police officer. So, you know, those are the things that first come out of the shooting. We have eyewitness reports that say, hey, you know, in the last couple of weeks, we saw a guy sitting out in front of the Siegel house. He was in work clothes, wore a uniform, and he often stayed there for very, very long periods of time, sometimes into the evening hours. This came from the resident of the 808 Linden home, which is just to the south of Siegel's murder location. Now, Barney Radusky was an NYP detective, and he was tied to Siegel because he did investigations for Ben through the Flamingo. He tracked down various leads and did things. Well, he was called to the Siegel site the night of the crime, and he gave his opinion later to Beverly Hills PD and to the Organized Crime and Commerce Commission here in Vegas couple of years later that he was under the impression that the Siegel murder wasn't a professional job. His professional opinion was Siegel's killer was someone from the local area who wasn't a professional trigger man and who hadn't done that type of gang warfare. So police, again, are putting all this information into there, be on the lookout for it. It's just information at this point. These are possible leads. When you talk about the people who want to do harm to Ben Siegel, three names immediately come up to the top of the list. The first, obviously, is Jack Dragna, who's the Los Angeles crime boss at the time, and he is the Sicilian in Southern California that Siegel was sent out to work with. The second is going to surprise a lot of people because they don't know the name, and it's not commonplace, but Billy Wilkerson. And for those of you who don't know who Billy Wilkerson is, Billy Wilkerson was actually the person who had the vision for the Flamingo, but more importantly, Billy Wilkerson was the publisher of the Hollywood Reporter back in the day. Very, very powerful player in Hollywood. Billy Wilkerson ran the nightclubs in L.A. He was the nightclub king. He ran Ciro's, the Trocadero Club. He had several other clubs. But as you're going to find out, Billy Wilkerson was the visionary for the Flamingo. And Siegel muscled him off the project. So he was one of those guys that was considered a possible suspect in this. The other one was Mo Sedway. And Mo came west with Siegel, and he and Ben were both sent out by Maya Lansky and Charlie Luciano to develop and cultivate Las Vegas and Los Angeles. So from our bolo, we're going to look for six major aspects to a possible link. We want a person in possession of a .30 caliber and or .45 caliber machine gun, a person that could be from the local area, a person who may have a job that requires him to wear work clothes and or a uniform. The other thing was the person was sitting in a small sedan. So the person sitting across from the Siegel home was somebody who drove a small sedan. That came from the resident of 808 Linden. You look at Barney Radusky and you want a person who's not a professional and who's not doesn't really have a hard connection to organized crime. Also, they should have a tie to either Jack Dragna, Billy Wilkerson, or Mo Sedway. Denny, you're a former cop. That's not a lot to go on, but at least it's a start for looking into things. Now, interestingly enough, as we all know, the Siegel murder kind of goes along and trugs along, and absolutely nothing happens. There's no real leads in the case at all. In April of 1948, Beverly Hills Police Chief Clinton Anderson sends out a request to Director J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI, and he wants special agents to assist him in the investigation of the Siegel murder. Hoover declines the request, but tells the chief that he's going to send whatever he can and get whatever help he can. This, to me, indicates a couple of things. The first one would be, why is Anderson, when he has all these agencies helping him and assisting him in the Siegel case, after 18 months, he decides, I think I need the FBI, and I don't really want to work with these guys who are helping me, who includes, again, the district attorney, county sheriff, LAPD. Those are the guys who he should have been calling on, not the FBI. What Anderson doesn't know is that Hoover had been diverting information from his agency to the LAPD and really preventing the Beverly Hills PD from gathering any kind of usable information in the Siegel case. Strange, but again, that was one of those memos that you and I went over, and we just kind of raised our eyes and said, oh, my gosh, that means something here. So,
yeah, Warren, I'd like to just emphasize that again in case people didn't catch what I think is the importance is. Now, you've got the feds, the FBI under Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover at the time, getting a request from the police chief of Beverly Hills for their assistance in the case. He's got all these other agencies and entities already involved in the investigation on a local or state basis, but he reaches out to the feds. Hoover says they aren't going to actually take over the case or become really involved, but what they will do is if they pick up any information or develop any information, anything comes their way, they will get it to the chief. What the chief doesn't know is that Hoover has already begun to send the information he's telling that he would send to Beverly Hills. He's sending that to the Los Angeles Police Department and bypassing Beverly Hills, which is technically the agency of jurisdiction because the murder took place in Beverly Hills. So am I correct in that?
Oh, absolutely. And you and I had that aha moment when we were looking at those files where the special agent in charge sent that memo to himself saying, I've been directed by my supervisor to divert information from Beverly Hills to the LAPD. And the reason for that we're going to get into, but I think that, you know, as we find out, it was important for the Beverly Hills PD not to have the information regarding the Siegel matter. It was more important for the LAPD to have that information, and we're going to share with the listeners why in a couple minutes. Now, the other interesting piece on this is Clinton or Chief Anderson implies, and this is a couple months after he gets the rejection letter from Hoover. Well, Anderson goes back to New York and says, I know who killed Ben Siegel. And the grand jury here in Los Angeles says, oh, you do? Well, we'd like to know who that is. So they call Chief Anderson in to testify. He spends an hour talking to the grand jury. And at the end of that conversation and his testimony, a high-ranking official comes out and says 99% of what Chief Anderson is nil, nothing. It's not very important. However, 1% of his testimony was of such importance that a secret investigation would be needed to conclude and bring closure to the Siegel murder. So before they can solve the case, they need to conduct a secret investigation before they're going to say case closed. That's a huge piece of this story. And the question that I'm going to pose to listeners is, keep in mind, is our story going to match what could possibly be that 1% that the chief is talking about that is so important that a secret investigation would be warranted and it would have to be hush-hush because it is going to involve something very big and something that really could be very far-reaching. That's the key thing to keep in mind as I share the story with you. The other piece that is interesting is Anderson throws one quip out and one whammy to the LAPD and the press, and he alludes to the fact that, hey, everybody, I don't have an answer to the Siegel murder, but the LAPD, they're the kind of people that keep 30 caliber carbines in their lockers. And he didn't throw them under the bus per se, but he was implying that they were either involved in it or they had something to do with taking care of the murder weapon. That was the implication that I read from that, and other people's do as well. So an interesting little tidbit there to keep your mind wrapped around. This thing is really probably something very, very large. If a common gangster had killed Ben Siegel, Chick Hill had did it like some theories are out there, if Frankie Carbo did it, if Mickey Cohen did it, if any criminal committed this murder, I don't think a secret investigation of the grand jury would be warranted. I think that they would go ahead and investigate that as a police type situation. It wouldn't require that super secret grand jury stuff. So we go off into what could it possibly be? Here's the answer. 3 months after Ben Siegel is murdered, on September 17th, 1947, at 822 Warner Avenue, this is in West Los Angeles. It is less than 1 mile from where Ben Siegel was killed. 27-year-old Robert McDonald, a former infantry officer, uses a 30 caliber carbine rifle, and he murders his 24-year-old wife. Then he turns the weapon on himself and commits suicide. This should have been a red flag to every police officer who's investigating the Siegel crime. The use of a 30 caliber carbine rifle for any crime in Los Angeles, I did it. 5 year before search and 5 year after search, I found three crimes that were committed using the 30 caliber carbine rifle. The Siegel murder, the murder of Betty Ann McDonald, and the suicide of Robert McDonald. That's it. 30 caliber carbine rifle was used. Red flag. Right away, Robert McDonald should have been a possible suspect in the Siegel murder. Is that fair to say, you think, Denny?
Certainly, yes. You say red flag certainly is there.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're going to look at Robert McDonald. Now, go back to the BOLO. We know right away that Robert McDonald is a person in possession or having a 30 caliber carbine. He did it to kill his wife. as police go in and search the McDonald home, they also find a sizable collection of guns, and one of which is a .40 caliber machine gun. It's a Tommy gun. You now have weapon one and weapon two from the FBI report. The other part of the bolo is a person from the local area. It's already been determined that McDonald lives less than a mile from Siegel. A person who holds a job that requires him to wear work clothes. As I got going and I interviewed some family members, and specifically Robert McDonald's son, John, has been a tremendous asset in helping me gather this information and really provided a lot of the hard evidence via, you know, documents, via old tickets from the LAPD that his father received, war records, letters home. Well, what we know is that Robert had become very despondent with life. He had lost about $100,000 gambling, and his father at this time was teaching him a lesson and forcing him to work in one of his gas stations in Los Angeles. That position required him to wear a uniform. He was a service station attendant. That would have been one thing that they would have found out. The next thing is the person drives a small sedan. Robert McDonald, 5 days before the murder-suicide, receives a ticket that we have a copy of for speeding. And the type of car that he drives, a small sedan. Robert McDonald has no professional hard connection to organized crime. Had police investigated him, they would have discovered that he wasn't a mobster, but both his mother-in-law and father had very strong ties to three people. They were tied to Jack Dragna, Billy Wilkerson, and Mo Sedway. They all knew each other. They had business dealings together. This was a very small group back then, and that connection and how this all intertwines is what makes this story so fascinating and what really is going to lead us down the path that lets us say Bob McDonald is Bugsy Siegel's killer. And the way that I'm going to do that is I'm going to take you through the what was going on in the lives of both Gunnell, who is Gunnell Moretta, is Robert McDonald's mother-in-law, Betty Ann's mother, and Archie McDonald, who is Robert McDonald's father. These two people were probably the most powerful people in Southern California. A lot of people are going to call BS because Gunnell is a woman. Well, you're going to find out that Gunnell was a very, very powerful woman. She was a woman of tremendous influence. And the way that she got there is just fascinating. So what I want to do is I want to start with Gunnell's life and how her road really brought all these pieces together and led to this thing. And I know we're under the wire time-wise, and we've got about a half an hour to get through a 16-year investigation. So do you have any questions right now before I jump into this thing?
No, but I do have a comment. What we'll do, Warren, is for the follow-up show or part two, if you will, on the 11th, rather than feel too rushed, we can take as much of that show as we need to finish up. So don't, you know,
good
cut
deal.
Anything short that you think is important, worrying about
okay.
getting everything in tonight. If when we run out of time, you haven't made your full presentation, just remember where we stopped, and on the 11th, we'll continue to finish it, and then we'll get into the phone calls.
Good deal. And now here's one aspect, too, Denny, that I want people to embrace as we go into the story. There is a loophole in the law that did not require the murder of Ben Siegel to be solved. If, as I say, Robert McDonald murdered Ben Siegel, the moment Robert McDonald was dead, law enforcement was under no legal obligation to resolve the Ben Siegel killing. Even if Gunnell and Archie had gone in and said, Robert McDonald is the killer of Ben Siegel, here's the murder weapon, they didn't have to solve it. And we'll share with listeners why that is towards the end of the presentation. But you've got to keep that in mind, too. This is a case that wasn't solved because it didn't have to be. Now, who is Gunnell Moretta? Well, Gunnell Moretta is basically, this was my We are tied to the story via Gunnell. And Gunnell was my grandmother's sister-in-law. Gunnell was married to a young man named Rennie Rockwell. Rennie Rockwell was my grandmother's brother. Rennie Rockwell in 1919 was an up-and-coming construction contractor. He was a young kid from a construction family. He was looking to get a foot up. Gunnell is a very, very tragic story in that when she moved to California from Chicago, the day that she got put on the train, her father dies of a massive heart attack. So when her mom and her arrive in Southern California in the early 1900s, she is already one step behind. You know, she comes from a family of tremendous wealth, and all of a sudden, boom, you have this horrible situation where dad dies, mom comes out, single mom and a daughter. A couple years later, the mom passes away too. So Gunnell is in that limbo area where she's a teenager. Mom had remarried a very, very abusive man named Virgil Gaylord. So Gunnell is a 15, 16-year-old who's seeking solace in the arms of this young, strapping gentleman named Rennie Rockwell, who is the up-and-coming construction guy in L.A. Now, there's only one problem with construction in L.A. back in the early 1900s and the 1920s, and that is all the construction contracts are run through City Hall. And if you're familiar with the power base in Los Angeles at the time, organized crime basically was City Hall. The mayor and the police department, they were the ones who ran this thing. They were the ones who ran this corruption machine. And George Cryer did a pretty good job with it. He had a group of guys. They ran gambling. They ran brothels. They ran all this stuff. And everybody got a feedback or a kickback on these deals. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that with construction contracts, Cryer and his group really didn't have that much influence in it in terms of being able to provide workers for it. So what they did was they went to a Sicilian up-and-comer by the name of Jack Dragna. And the very, very first piece of the pie that Jack Dragna got as a young Sicilian mobster was via the construction contracts and the kickbacks provided by City Hall. So Jack Dragna was the guy who went out, looked for contractors, said, hey, I'll give you X amount of money. You give me X amount of money back. Everybody's happy. Dragna pays City Hall. City Hall gets a piece of the pie. And, you know, it still kind of works that way to this day, I'm sure, in a lot of areas. But that's how they did things in L.A. in the 1920s. A character comes into play here named Nick Moretta. Now, Nick Moretta is a longtime friend of the Dragna family, and he's not a mobster. He's kind of the guy who is the guy that's on the edge looking in, and he doesn't really want to be a mobster, but he wants a piece of the pie. Well, Nick Moretta knows Gunnell and Rennie Rockwell very, very well. Nick Moretta facilitates a meeting between Rennie Rockwell and Jack Dragna. Perfectly legit. Rennie's going to go to work for Jack. Rennie's going to get money. Rennie's going to make Gunnell happy because Gunnell wants money. She wants new cars. She wants clothes. She wants prestige. Nick Moretta's going to facilitate that. So Nick introduces Rennie to Jack Dragna. Very, very lucrative introduction. Rennie starts getting construction contracts. He's in on the building of L.A. City Hall. They are just making money hand over fist. Gunnell, Nick, Rennie, they all are good, good friends. Gunnell and Rennie decide to start a family. They have two children in the mid-20s. Betty Ann is the youngest daughter, and they have a son also. But Betty Ann's our focus point right now. So Betty Ann, who is murdered in 1947, is the daughter of Rennie and Gunnell Rockwell. Well, as I said, things go very, very well for the Rockwells for a period of time. They have a very good business going. If you go into L.A. right now, you can see RRC, Rennie Rockwell Construction, still on some of the sidewalks. That's how old some of those sidewalks are in L.A., is the early 20s. Well, tragedy kind of comes in a couple different forms. L.A. starts going through this reform where they want to drive out the evils of crime, and they look at the mayor's office and they see that George Cryer is the guy there. So they vote him out of office, and a new mayor takes over, and his name is John Porter. Now, Porter tries to do all these reforms, but something's coming up in the 20s that's called Black Tuesday. And Black Tuesday hurls us into the Depression era that is going to hit not just L.A., but the entire country. What's tragic here is about the same time Rennie Rockwell comes down with tuberculosis. So this young, strapping, strong construction contractor within a matter of several months becomes this sick, weakened man who is really on the last leg of his life. Now, Nick Moretta is there to help the family, to help out, to be the guy. But what happens is, while Rennie is sick, Gunnell and Nick start to have an affair and become an item. By 1930, Rennie Rockwell passes away, and now Gunnell is this single mother of two who's having an affair with Nick Moretta, and she doesn't know what she's going to do now. The money that she saves goes rather quickly. Rennie went very, very quickly from tuberculosis. Very, very tragic story. He died at the age of 30. So they go from having everything to really having nothing and being in a struggle situation. Gunnell is determined that she had that taste of the good life. She wants more of that. And she's going to do whatever she has to do to move up and increase her station in society. She is fortunate to land a position in the secretarial pool in City Hall. Now, during this time, she still maintains a relationship with Nick Moretta. She still maintains a little bit of a relationship with Jack Dragna also. Gunnell's strength was that she was very, very good with numbers. She was a figures kind of gal. She ran the business for Rockwell Construction. She was able to just recall everything. She probably had a photographic memory. And, you know, because of this, she was a tremendous asset in the secretarial pool. Well, eventually, the mechanics of the L.A. mafia, not mafia then, organized crime starts to crumble. They lose all their power base when Cryer goes, and then Porter comes in and kind of cleans things up a little bit. But by 1933, L.A. is kind of sick of the righteousness, and they want a little bit of vice. You know, getting rid of all the vice and trying to crack down, they didn't really go for that so much. So what they do is they decide that they're going to make another change. The mayor that comes in is a gentleman named Franklin Shaw. Now, I'd like readers or listeners to go in and really do some research on Shaw. Fascinating man. There's a lot of great books out there on this era, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the corrupt machine that Franklin Shaw put in place from 1933 to 1938, but it's incredible. And what happens is, Shaw and Jack Dragna have known each other since the early 20s, and this is their opportunity to take advantage of Franklin Shaw being the mayor of Los Angeles. Vice in L.A. goes through the roof, and Jack Dragna is right at the center of it. At the time of Dragna getting involved in this thing, he really has one player that he has to report to, and that person is Joe Shaw, Franklin's brother. They are divvying up money. They're splitting profits. The great thing about this is Franklin Shaw needs an executive assistant. And he has the perfect person with Gunnell Rockwell. Franklin Shaw, based on a recommendation from Jack Dragna, says, is this a woman that we can trust? Absolutely. So Gunnell becomes the executive assistant to the mayor of Los Angeles, Franklin Shaw, and she is knee-deep in one of the most corrupt political and law enforcement machines that the city of Los Angeles had ever known. She starts working with members of the LAPD. She starts working with the coroner's department, the district attorney's office, the state attorney general's office, the LA County Sheriff's Department. Gunnell is with these people. She is one of the ones that is giving the promotions out. If you're an officer and you want to be a sergeant, hey, see Gay, give her $250, she'll give you your sergeant stripes. If you want to be a lieutenant, a little bit more money. You're going to have to give her $500. So she knows every crooked cop, every crooked sheriff, every crooked district attorney. She's doing business with them. That's the way it is. But what she's doing is she's moving up in her position. She's learning. She's meeting lieutenants, captains, chiefs of police. She's attending functions. One of the key functions she attends, and this is probably 1937, was given for a young aviator named Howard Hughes. Her and Franklin Shaw attend a luncheon that was given for Howard Hughes in 1937. At this luncheon, she meets a gentleman named Archibald McDonald. The two have something in common. Gunnell has a 15-year-old daughter. Archie has a 17-year-old son named Robert. So as we progress through this thing, you can see that Gunnell is making inroads to the Los Angeles political machine. She is right there in it. But the bottom line is, she's still a secretary. She still doesn't have what she craves the most. And what that is she wants that social status. She wants to be that old money gal. So what does she do? She finds a gentleman by the name of Ralph Applegate. Now, in 1937, Gunnell is 37 years old. She has two children. And she meets this guy, Ralph Applegate, who's an investment banker. And she makes the decision that I'm going to marry Ralph Applegate. Ralph Applegate is 57 years old. He's been married for 20 years. By 1938, Gunnell has broken up his marriage, and she is now Gunnell Applegate. She leaves Mayor Shaw's office. She says, I have found what I wanted. I'm leaving this position, and she marries into great wealth. But more importantly, Ralph Applegate is a big-timer with the socially elite of Southern California, which is just what Gunnell wanted. Now, what I'm going to do is regress just a little bit. I'm going to talk about someone who I think is one of the most fascinating people that we don't know about, but that we should, because he was that powerful in person, and that's Archie McDonald. Now, Archie McDonald was the right-hand man to Howard Hughes. Archie's career with the Hughes Corporation and with the Hughes Tool Company basically started with Big Howard, and that is Howard Hughes' father. So Archie was on the ground floor of the Sharp Hughes Tool Company when Big Howard developed the drill bit that opened up the oil fields. He was sent out in 1924 to become the manager of the Hughes Tool Company located in L.A. He was the man here in L.A., and he was young. Now, Archie's association with Howard really began at this time when Howard started coming out to California. He was the one, not Rupert, who was Howard Hughes Sr.'s brother. It was Archie and his wife, Ella, who really took care of Hughes when he came out and visited and did things. He was Howard Hughes' caretaker when he was a young kid visiting California without mom and dad. Well, again, as people get to know Howard Hughes and know that story, they know that, tragically, Hughes loses both of his parents. He loses his mom in 1922. She dies from, I believe, a childbirth issue. And then Howard Hughes Sr. passes away in 1924. This leaves Howard Jr. as the sole owner of one of the richest, fastest-developing businesses in the United States. Archie is such a critical component of that organization that he's actually an executive member of the first board of directors for the Hughes Tool Company. In the only will ever executed by Howard Hughes, Archie is named a 3% beneficiary in the only legitimate will that was ever done by Howard Hughes, which is just amazing to me. As you know, Hughes comes out west. He starts to get into movies, golfing, and of course he becomes the great aviator. Now, I'm going to regress a little bit here again, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Noah Dietrich. Everybody thinks Noah Dietrich was the right-hand man to Howard Hughes. You see it all over the place. You know, Noah was the one in the aviator. Noah was the one who was the troubleshooter. No disrespect to Noah Dietrich, but Noah Dietrich was the bookkeeper. Noah Dietrich was also based not in California, but in Houston, Texas. Howard Hughes as a young man was a young man who had money. He had cravings for young women. He had Hollywood. He had aviation. He had all these things. Archie was the one who took care of him. As I got to know Archie a little bit, he had the nickname the Guardian of the Empire that was given to him by some of the people way back in the day of the Hughes Corporation, and for good reason. He was the one who kept all of Howard Hughes' secrets. Now, one of the secrets that people really aren't aware of with Hughes is that he had a very, very close relationship with a number of members of organized crime. And I'll throw out just a couple names that people know: Maya Lansky, Charlie Luciano, Ben Siegel. Howard Hughes and Ben Siegel had a very good friendship from the 30s on, and it would make sense. You know, George Raff was in a Hughes film called Scarface. George Raff and Hughes were very good friends. George Raff and Ben Siegel, as we all know, were very good friends. So he developed this relationship with these mobsters because it was kind of fun. You know, it was exciting. It was thrilling. But in the meantime, that leaves poor Archie to put out all the little fires that are taking place. Archie does a very good job of doing that. Now, the other thing to be cognizant of is that Archie was one of the few people that knew Howard Hughes from the time that he was a very small boy until the time of his death. One of the things that Archie was there to troubleshoot was Hughes' relationship with countless women. Hughes liked starlets. He liked young girls. Sometimes those girls created issues. Archie's job was to make sure those issues never surfaced publicly. A lot different. TMZ wasn't around back then. Had they been, I'm sure they would have dedicated an entire block of programming to Howard Hughes. I mean, he just ran with that type of people. So now you get an idea on how powerful Archie is, how powerful Gunnell is, and these are the two people that are going to come together when eventually their daughter and son become man and wife. Now, what I have to do is bounce back a little bit and mention Bugsy Siegel. Ben Siegel pretty much comes out to California at the request and the direction of Charlie Luciano. He and Mo Sedway are going to come west. Sedway's going to develop Las Vegas. Siegel's going to work with Jack Dragna in Los Angeles and try to enhance the L.A. Mafia. The L.A. Mafia doesn't have a really good reputation in the media. But let me tell you about the L.A. Mafia under Jack Dragna. They were, in Bugsy, you say, hey, we got these small organizations, we're going to make them big, you make this much money, we're going to do this. According to the Hollywood Citizen, in 1938-37, Jack Dragna's organization was making $2 million a month. 20% of that was going to the police, the politicians, and the newspaper reporters. The Daily News, however, says that he's making $50 million a year. He has over 600 brothels, 300 gambling locations, and 1,800 bookie joints. He's not small potatoes. What Siegel doesn't understand when he comes out west is you can't do things in L.A. the way they did things in New York, Chicago, Cleveland. There was some real abrasiveness in the way that he handled it. What it did was it really created a rift with not necessarily Dragna, but with the real power players in Los Angeles who were the L.A. politicians, the L.A. power players. They didn't want flashy. They're a lot like the guys who were the ones that were the mafiosa. They don't like flashy either. They demand that there's this investigation on crime. So who do they put in charge of the investigation? Franklin Shaw. Franklin Shaw does a crime commission that's filled with a group of people that are the sheriff, the undersheriff, some cops. Most of them are crooks themselves. So they kind of look at it and they say, no, there's nothing really going on here in L.A. It's all good. Well, Bugsy doesn't like that, and neither do a couple of the high-ranking cops. So what they decide to do is continue on with the way that they've done things. Well, the Crusaders decide we're going to investigate it on our own. And they do an investigation on their own, and what they find out is there is tremendous graft and corruption in L.A. And eventually, all these things tie back to City Hall. They go through this 6, 7, 8 month investigation. The mayor's corrupt. His brother's corrupt. We got corrupt cops everywhere. And Shah's regime begins to crumble. It starts to fall apart. The light is too strong. Shah is going to have to battle for his job. He ends up losing a recall election based on all of the corruption allegations that have been going on. And a lot of those situations were brought to light by Ben Siegel and his approach of doing things. Very, very boisterous, very very much what you would think a gangster would do. Even though he thought he was doing the right thing, and it probably was the right thing for a guy from New York, it didn't fly in L.A. So by 1938, Shah's regime falls, and L.A. becomes wide open again. There's kind of a lull in things, but the power brokers are the cops and the politicians and a few of the gangsters, and it's just gone bad. Now, the one person who makes out is Gunnell. Gunnell is out of the game by now. She is living her life, and she is in Bel Air, California. She is far, far away from L.A., and she has a 15-year-old daughter who's going to meet the man of her dreams, and the man of her dreams is a young man named Bob McDonald. These two meet in 1939. They begin a whirlwind romance, and what I mean by whirlwind is they're having parties at the Coconut Grove. They're partying at Ciro's. One of the really cool articles that we found, Denny, and that I showed you, was that they had a dance competition at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and Bob McDonald won the dance competition, and the gal that he beat was Shirley Temple. So, you know, these are the kind of people that the McDonalds are hobnobbing with. Now, as we get going through this romance, they take trips to Catalina on Howard Hughes' yacht. They dance all night in the ballrooms there. Well, one thing leads to another, and eventually the couple decide that they're going to get married. Now, the decision is kind of made for them because what happens is Betty Ann becomes pregnant. A 17-year-old pregnant in 1940 isn't really a good thing. And they arrange the marriage. The couple becomes man and wife in June. In November of 1941, John Angus McDonald is born. So there's kind of a lapse there. We needed a few more months for that to be a legitimate child. But there's one key component in this. Betty Ann confesses to a handful of family members, one of which is my mother, that the father of her child could be one of two men, Robert McDonald or Howard Hughes. Now, right away, probably three-quarters of your listeners went, oh, that's BS. How does this tie in? That can't be. Go to the Facebook page. And, Denny, I know you took a look at the picture of John McDonald now and compared it to Howard Hughes, and I'll let you give a non-biased opinion of whether you think there is a possibility that that statement is true just based on the photo.
I was struck. In fact, if you didn't know better, you could think it was just pictures of the same person at different ages.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Pictures were there, and until you told me, these were actually two different men, you know, the Hughes and then John. I would have thought it was the same person with photos taken at different times in that person's life.
Incredible. It really is. And I encourage people to go take a look at that photograph, because every time I show that when I speak or when we present, I just get a gasp from the audience. And people are like, are you kidding me? This
Warren, we're down to our last minute. Would this be a good place to break? I think it might
be. Yeah, this is going to be an excellent place to break. We'll give a pause here because we're just going to get into the development of Las Vegas and the Flamingo, and Ben Siegel comes in. But just as kind of a recap, what we've got now is we've got an arranged marriage. We've got the possibility, because we don't have all the testing back then that we do now, that Howard Hughes is father to child, and that child is John McDonald, whose photograph is on Facebook. And the other important piece that we can leave in is if there, I kind of had my doubts because I had never met John or seen him before I had heard this rumor. And then I found out that Betty Ann was a 17-year-old. We have documentation that she had $100,000 deposited in her bank account in 1940 after the wedding. Now, $100,000 back then would be the equivalent to a whole lot of money right now. And who had a whole lot of money back then to be able to pay off a potential illegitimate child? That would have been Howard Hughes. And Archie McDonald would have facilitated that. The real tragedy in this, Denny, I think people are going to find out, is really going to be Robert McDonald. He is a young kid whose spouse, who he's going to have to marry, may have fathered or mothered a child by a different man, and that sets us in perfectly to the spiral that he's going to go through and the problems and the issues. But imagine living in 1940 with a child that you don't know is yours, and you're living in the shadow of Howard Hughes. That's a tough gig for anybody. And it just gets more fascinating from here.
Absolutely agreed. So we'll pick this up in 2 weeks on the 11th of December, and we'll finish it off. What I would encourage listeners to do is visit the Facebook site, Family Secret, look at the photos, look at any other information, make some of your own decisions, do your own research, and after Warren completes to the presentation on December 11th, call in, tell Warren, tell us what you think. If you agree, disagree, if you have questions, whatever, and we'll try to get a consensus of who killed Bugsy Siegel. Warren, thank you so much for being with us tonight, and I can't wait to talk to you again on December 11th.
Thanks, Danny. Thanks, Kim.
Okay, and thank everybody for listening. There will be the next Crime Wire show will be on December 4th, and we'll be starting at a new time of 7 p.m. Eastern. At 7 p.m. Eastern, December 4th, and the host for that show will be Statement Analyst Peter Hyatt. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com, turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Good night, Warren. Good night, Kim.
Good night.